Be careful because you can easily be throwing away the performance. Maybe people out there have got some decisions, got some opinions on it. If so, give me your call letters right now. HURIW and the TechNet.
Roger, I went for a demonstration to see you, this new connector deck.
Okay, give us a few words on that one, Mel. What brand name, what did you see, and did they do some form of confirmation confirming that they were getting something like 120 dB or better of shielding of that crimp connector? You got it, Mel.
Well, they got it accepted by the military. I went over to this place where they were demonstrating it. It is one heck of a connector that they came up with. It showed, like, for instance, B and C connectors, which were used, of course, predominantly used in our industry at the time, was B and C. And what it does is a process, actually, the special contraption. It fuses the center pin. It's a three-piece B and C connector, and it fuses the pin. The center pin first, the gold-plated center pin is fused right to the copper by a process, this special contraption that they have, that you stick it in there, strips it, and then fuses it. Then you stick it together, it's got like a ring that goes in there, slips in the ring, very easy to ring, and then another piece behind it into the sleeve, and then it compresses it together with this another contraption of a machine. And when it's, in other words, the whole thing is fused together under tremendous amounts of pressure. In fact, they put it through all kinds of tests. In fact, it was accepted to the military spec now. It's expensive to connect to the BNCs. I think was $3.75 a piece for BNC, and the end connector, if I'm not wrong, I think was $8 and change, about $8.25 a connector. But I'll tell you something, from what I've seen, it looked good, and they've subjected it. They said, you tell us a test, and we'll show you specs on it, everything from RF to being dunked in the sea to lifting equipment, you know, lifting things. They show a picture of it, lifting up the piece of cable with the thing on there, two of them connected together, and lifting the front end of a truck or some goddamn thing like that with the cable. I tell you the truth, it is an expensive but a very good process, Dick. Over.
WB2HWW.
Howie recognized something you just said, though, Mel, put me off a little bit, and that is, to my knowledge, no mil spec equipment uses BNC connectors. BNC stands for Bayonet Neil Councilman. Mr. Neil and Mr. Councilman, way back around 1938 at Bell Labs, invented what we now call the BNC connector. The good news about the Bayonet Neil Councilman connector is that it's a very fast connect and disconnect. And when you're setting up bench test equipment, an extremely handy connector indoors. To my knowledge, nobody uses it as on mil-spec equipment. A TNC connector, the threaded Neil Councilman connector, yes, that's on mil-spec equipment. But essentially, no BNC connectors are in critical locations. To my knowledge, nobody has ever built the jumper cables for a duplexing filter with BNC connectors. There may be a rare one out there that has tried it, but the bayonet connector is very fast to connect, but it doesn't give anywhere near as positive a mating as you get with a threaded connector like TNC or Type N. So the fact that this crimping process that you witnessed is good enough for BNC, I'll accept that for indoor service on BNC. I wouldn't accept it for outdoor service yet, and I wouldn't accept it for duplexing filter jumper service, a very, very severe service. But then you went on to say that they also were doing it with Type N connectors. Now, a Type N connector on RG213-like cable, single braid cable, yeah, you can do a pretty good job with that. But if you're using RG214, RG9, any of the cables, or RG223, which is the BNC sized of a cable with double shield, any of the cables that have double shield, can you get all of the integrity of the shielding capability of the double shield combined with a crimping operation? I'm having some trouble with that. So when you saw that demonstration, Mel, was it double shielded cable that was being crimped? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, they were crimping for all kinds. And yes, it is mil-spec. In fact, Dick, I have a number of B and C cables, jumper cables, that came from surplus, that were Army surplus, that were made for the military, definitely, the mark on it, J-A-N, and they were all used, whole loads of them. I picked them up, and I wanted to salvage the connectors off of these pieces of cable, basically. These are the ones that were put together with the compression nut. So they came from Uncle Sam, and I have a whole pile of them. They're terrific connectors. And the end connector, yep, they're selling them. In fact, I saw on one of the dishes that I noticed on a couple of the dishes that they had, and it looked like, you know, and yeah, it had end connectors on it that were crimped on, Dick.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Howie in a second. When it comes to internal wiring used between the mixer and the IF strip and whatever, inside of the cabinet of mil-spec equipment, without a doubt, I've seen BNC connectors for IF jumpers and things like this. But when it comes to the main RF connector on the front end going to the antenna, rarely do you see BNC there. And all the mil-spec Air Force and Navy hardware I've worked on, it's always TNC, type N, mostly TNC, or waveguide on the outside of the LRUs. That's the slang for line replaceable unit on Air Force hardware, or WRA, weapon replaceable assembly, is what's used on Navy hardware. And those are almost always TNCs. Maybe Howie has seen some real high-quality crimping connectors that he has faced, and let's find out. You got it, Howie, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I don't have no faith in any of them, Dick. I know that Tesco, because three or four years ago I bought cables, and I had them made up for a cell wave duplexer for a certain frequency, and it came crimped on. I was very unhappy. The guy said, well, it's the only way we do it. By the way, Dick, I've seen BNC connectors on duplexes. I once bought, many years ago, a TXRX four-cavity duplexer, and it came with BNCs. I used it for a couple of months and got rid of it. I agree with you. Using BNCs with RG-142? No way, Jose. I don't like them. They don't work well. Back to you, Dick.
Well, you said a mouthful there, Howie, when you said it was a four-cavity duplexer. If you only need 80 or 90 dB of shielding between the transmitter and the receiver, a four-cavity duplexer will do it. But if you want full performance in a dense environment, you want a six-cavity duplexing filter. And there you're looking for 120 to 130 some odd dB of shielding and isolation between transmit frequency and receive frequency. And on 2 meters, they're only 600 kc apart. I'd like to believe no self-respecting company who produces what they think is a viable six-cavity duplexing filter for frequencies like 2 meters or 450 would ever use BNC connectors for the jumpers in that service. That's my belief. But I'll stand corrected if somebody can find an exception. And let's face it, what we used to think was a super good battery, they're getting better and better. And maybe it's just a matter of time before somebody comes up with just the right materials and just the right assembly tools to do a real good job of putting on crimp connectors and getting full performance of the normal hand-installed connector, where I literally spend 10 minutes per connector. But in my opinion, it's a good investment for outdoor service, because if I do the job correctly, I will own that cable, and it will, that jumper cable that goes around my rotator will say, my favorite cable there is RG9 with a hand-installed, carefully installed type N connector. Properly done, 10 or 15 years later, that thing is working and no water is crawled in there. Now, on the subject of transmission lines, I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction. Mel doesn't know about this. He's about to give us his third lecture in the series on the Smith chart, and I'm going to give a little bit of a justification of what he's doing. Let me drop.
Dick, can I make a comment before you get on?
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
I agree with you 100%. I would do not want, but to get to pay a man or to call up Tesco and have them make you up cables, if they had a solder, they would have to charge you another $100-some-odd. Labor is very expensive, but I will tell you, there are manufacturers out there, and I want to mention them, who have built six-cavity duplexes with BNCs. And you know what my attitude is? They're not getting my money.
Yeah, when it's brand new and everything is assembled just right, they may squeak by the isolation and leakage performance. But a BNC connector, in my mind, is capable of very, very easily giving you what's called pin performance failures. PIN stands for passive intermodulation distortion. All of your cell phone stations these days are very careful on the selection of the materials that go into connectors to be sure there isn't the slightest chance of dissimilar metals creating PIN, passive intermodulation distortion. When you've got a cell site that's got a whole lot of transmitters packed in real tight, and it may be on the side of the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building or whatever, a really dense, rich environment of RF somewhere in New York City, it is possible for the connectors on the end of your cable to create phony signals, intermodulation distortion, as if you are overloading an amplifier. Believe it or not, and I've seen it. I've seen it on high-quality spectrum analyzers with a carefully done test. I've seen PIN. And one of the craziest places I saw it was on a Hewlett-Packard 10 dB step attenuator. It went from 0 to 70 dB. It was rated for 0 to 18 gigahertz. It was one of the very high-quality. You take it apart inside, everything is all gold-plated. The spring contacts that do the switching on the 70 dB 0 to 18 gigahertz step attenuator. But because one of those spring fingers was not making good contact to the resistive card, the attenuator card for one of the steps, a 10 dB or a 20 dB step, unless you rock the knob on it just right, it would, during a two-tone test, a high-quality two-tone test, it was generating intermodulation distortion. So I've seen passive intermodulation distortion. I've been hearing about it for years. I thought people were just being super conservative until I've encountered it. And I encountered that 6 or 8 months ago in a good laboratory. And so keep going back to that particular piece of equipment. And I personally took it apart inside and looked. Under a microscope, I can't see anything wrong. But when I replaced that particular card, the particular attenuator step card inside, which, by the way, is not a recommended procedure from Hewlett-Packard. It's supposed to be a factory precision alignment. You buy the service manual for the high-quality SMA type 18 gigahertz Agilent / Hewlett-Packard step attenuators. Nowhere do they sell you the parts that go inside, and nowhere do they tell you how to do a repair procedure. They don't want anybody in the field doing that. Well, I having to buy one of these machines at a flea market, and I did something dumb like pouring transmitter power through it and damaged one of the cards, and I wanted to replace it. And now I can sort of see why they don't want field replacement. It's a very precision microscope operation to do that. Now, let me drop for a second. In the early days of ham radio, most of us used to live in wooden houses of 2 or 3 floors, and there usually was an attic. And the attic is where you store the stuff that was too valuable to throw away, but not valuable enough to put into the living quarters. And the ham radio operator frequently got shoved into the attic. As long as he wore his coat in the wintertime and through this wooden building, he would send one half of his dipole out the north window, the other half of his dipole out the south window. In the middle, he put his transmitter, and he's on the air. Everything's hunky-dory. Well, eventually, our houses became more elaborate. The ham wanted to operate from another room downstairs or in the basement, and he needed a transmission line. So the transmission line takes that valuable transmitter power, brings it up to the top of the house, to the chimney, to the top of the tower, and you want that transmission line to act like a pipe. If you were installing a faucet, a drinking fountain in the attic of that house, you would simply bring a pipe up there, and your local water authority would supply enough pressure to the pipe. You would send the water up the pipe, and at the third floor, you open up the faucet, out pours the water. If the pipe is large enough in diameter to give you enough flow, if you've got enough pressure at the bottom, you've got enough pressure at the top, everything works. And you would like the coax cable running from the basement of your house up to the chimney to act exactly like a water pipe. You'd like to put 100 watts into the bottom. You'd like to get 98 watts up at the top. And if your antenna is 50 ohms, back at the bottom of the pipe, the bottom of the transmission line in the basement, you'd like to see 50 ohms. Transmission line is a little bit like a pipe on a good day. But here's the catch. Mistreat that transmission line. In the case of the pipe going to the faucet, you could build a faucet at the end that doesn't have a big enough opening, doesn't have a clean on-off characteristic or two or whatever, you can get away with that. In the case of that transmission line that goes from your transmitter to the top of the chimney or the top of the tower, if that antenna at your favorite frequency is not a 50-ohm resistor, even if it's a 50-ohm pure capacitor, that ain't good enough. It's got to be a 50-ohm resistor with no leftover capacitance or inductance. As long as your antenna meets that criteria, everything's hunky-dory, you buy the right transmission line, treat it correctly, put connectors on the end correctly, and you plug in your wattage at the bottom, your transmitter sees 50 ohms, the antenna is 50 ohms, and it works. As anything deviates from that situation with the transmission line, as soon as your antenna goes a little bit higher or a little bit lower in resistance, or if you've tuned the antenna, it's a simple dipole, and you've tuned it to 3700, but now you go to 3995 to talk to that particular net, and you're off-center tune where the antenna is now acting inductive. The 50 ohms has gone to 65 ohms resistive, and the inductance that used to be zero is now 35 ohms of inductive reactance. All of a sudden, the antenna is not a pure resistance. And common sense would lead you to believe, okay, the antenna is 70 ohms resistive and 35 ohms reactance at the antenna. You'd like to believe at the other end of the transmission, you're going to see the exact same impedance. Transmission line does not behave that way. You have anything but 50 ohms at the end. You then have to know the length of the transmission line electronically, because now the impedance that you see at the input end of the transmission line goes through multiple cycles of change in impedance depending on the length of the line. And that length of line can be changing because you've literally plugged in a different length of coax cable with an adapting connector, or you've swept to another frequency, which means the same number of feet of line is now a different number of wavelengths long. So all you have to know for sure is that there's a complicated formula where if somebody tells you the length of the line in wavelengths to the nearest couple of degrees, electrical degrees, which for most of our frequencies represents a couple of inches of error, as long as they tell you the length of the line to the nearest couple of inches on HF frequencies, the impedance of the line, the velocity of the line, and the frequency you're operating at, and if they also tell you the impedance of your antenna, with this great big complicated formula, you can predict what impedance the transmitter is going to see down in the shack. And the first time you hear this jazz, you say, what in the world is going on? Why did somebody design transmission line that complicated? Why does it act like that? The formulas will drive you crazy. There are some very simple formulas that you can use if the transmission line happens to be an exact multiple of a half wavelength long. In that condition, and only that condition, it tends to repeat impedance. Whatever the antenna is, the transmitter will see the exact same impedance if the cable is an exact number of half wavelengths long at your current frequency. Anything else, it goes into this complicated phenomenon. The formula will drive you crazy. A guy named Smith in 1938 at Bell Labs invented this chart where you put a dot on the chart that represents the impedance of your particular crazy antenna or the next stage of a transmitter or whatever. You put a dot on the chart, and then you adjust from the center of the chart out to that dot your compass, and you swing a circle with your compass. That line that you have just drawn represents all the possible impedances your transmitter will see every time you slowly stretch that cable one half wavelength. Every time you go one half length wavelength of extra cable, you will make one more circle on that line you just drew with your compass on that Smith chart. And each time you stop at some particular point on that circle, you're defining the impedance that your transmitter is going to see at that particular frequency for that length of line for that particular antenna. It doesn't make the situation simple, but it makes it a lot more understandable, that Smith chart. That's one of 10 different ways you can use a Smith chart, but this is the most basic way. It gives you some idea of the value the darn thing has. Why has it been around since 1938 to now is 68 years. It's been around for 68 years. It has essentially been unchanged for 68 years. People have added other things to it. They've added a whole bunch of charts on alongside of the Smith chart, a whole bunch of nomographs and linear graphs and whatever. And you can also buy the Smith chart in multiple colors, so that it gives you both impedance and admittance. And you can flip back and forth between the two on the chart without using your ruler, so to speak. But still, people have added to it. But the basic chart was a real stroke of genius. And so, too bad Mr. Smith is not around. He continued to get awards on this, because here we are as RF engineers 68 years later, still using the Don thing and say, hey, that guy was all right. He was pretty smart. He did something good. So, to make an investment, to learn how to use a Smith chart, as Mel and I have been telling you, it's a darn good investment. You become good with a Smith chart, whatever wireless company you work for, they're going to treat you with greater respect. They're going to lay out the red carpet. They're going to bring in the fancy-looking ladies to bring you lunch. All these good things are going to happen once you learn how to use a Smith chart. And Mel is now about to give you course number 3 on that subject. And by the time you get to course number 5 and you get the degree from Mel, oh, man, you're going to be treated with respect. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Smith charts are red, Dick.
Say that again?
You said a red carpet. I'm laughing. I remember the Smith chart was red. It had red writing on it.
In the original one that you got on thin little onion skin paper, you're absolutely right. The modern one you get with your Adobe Acrobat printing process off the internet is generally black, but they do give you a blue version on top of it when you want to simultaneously print the admittance chart as well as the impedance chart, but a very valuable piece of paper. Mel, you got the floor.
Okay, yeah, Roger. In fact, I have one, a rubber stamp. It's a curved, it's an unusual thing. I don't know who made the thing. It was like a curved piece of rubber with a handle on it, and you could stamp actually the paper with it wherever you're working. If you want to put a Smith chart, a 3.5-inch Smith chart, right next to your information that you're writing up and want to have it on the same page. And you can't get them anywhere anymore. I tried a number of places. And the Smith chart, yes, that they now send, that they have online called the Black Magic Design, which I like. I have some of the older ones also, red and all that kind of jazz, but nothing wrong with this one, to tell you the truth. The last word on the end connector business there, they said here, I got a little thing on it, it says, exceeds military specs ANSI-J-STD-001B, whatever the heck that means, the military specs, so that's what they said it exceeds. The processing unit to put the connector on is $1,938 by itself. And they said a fusing process everything together. And I believe by hand you could never get an end connector on like that, Dick. The way that thing is, actually I understand what they did is the center pin, when they fuse it on, if they cut it, they made a fine cut right through it. You can't tell where the wire was and the connector pieces. You know, you don't see no separation. Some kind of fusing process, I tell you. Well, like I say, everything new. All kinds of new things coming up. You got to have an open mind to everything, Dick. You never know what's coming next. You mentioned about battery packs. Yeah, I took apart one of the lithium battery packs. I salvaged just the pack inside. I wanted to use it for something else. And the inside, the batteries are wrapped separate. And you should see that wrapping. You know, they took a lot of care. They don't just depend on the case to protect, yourself. They wrap it in a special wrapping inside there that's makes it a lot safer, because I guess they couldn't depend on the plastic case with the lithium battery takeover. Nick.
Doesn't surprise me, because that lithium is wicked stuff. You don't want it to come in contact with your skin. The one case I've heard about is where there was a failure of the case on a cell phone, and it did give the person significant burns and possibly permanent scarring of his face. We've also heard stories of the batteries on laptop radios, laptop computers that are lithium-based, that have failed recently and created a significant fire, smoke and flames, and essentially destroyed the laptop and its memory device. So, Sony right now is going through quite a number of millions of dollars of recall, millions of dollars of cost to recall. Sony, I think, is one of the largest manufacturers of lithium-based batteries. Sony I think it's Hanyo and Sony. There's a recall going on right now because of some failure, because of some metal chips that are inside that are creating short circuits between anodes and cathodes. If you get a short internal to the battery itself, the protection circuit that's in almost every lithium battery on the outside of the battery, outside of the cells, but inside of the battery pack, there's a protection circuit in almost every rechargeable lithium battery you can buy. And that protection circuit cannot protect you if deep inside the cell itself, if there is a short-circuiting whisker between the anode and the cathode because of some metal chips and shards that shouldn't be in there. That is capable of now creating smoke and flames and breaching of the case and spilling the lithium around and creating all kinds of grief that you don't want to know about. And so rather than go through all those lawsuits, they're making sure they're recalling that whole production run right now. And it's costing them quite a few $1 million. It's a story we haven't heard the end of yet, and it just keeps getting worse and worse as we find out which brand names were marked on the outside of the batteries, which brand names the laptop computers they went into, and which brand names are being are recalled. And it's a pretty big story as I see it. K2KEY in the group, K2RIW in the middle, and TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. I'll tell you something. You've seen more fires than anywhere else in automobiles caused by the old lead-acid battery that's been around 100 years. So everything, you know, has its danger. And used correctly, used properly, I don't think you have too much worry. But my brother used to have down in the scrapyard where he was manager down there, he'd throw a lot of cars on a pile. And every so often, they throw a car up on the junk pile there that they've got to take the battery out of it. And it's short circuit, and they had a couple of real bad fires from lead-acid batteries, Dick, over.
Doesn't surprise me. Whenever you've got something that stores a lot of energy in a small package, whether it be a gallon of gasoline, a gallon of fuel oil, any battery that's fully charged, a tank with liquid hydrogen, because you want a hydrogen-powered vehicle, liquid propane, any of these devices that have got a lot of high-energy substance in a small package, there's almost always some kind of a way that the energy starts leaking out in an uncontrolled manner that's going to give you trouble. In the case of a nuclear power station, you've got a year's supply of food and a year's supply of fuel, or maybe 2 or 3 years' supply of fuel, all in one spot at one time. By the control rods and everything else and the safety systems you've got in that nuclear power station, you do what the early nuclear scientists used to say, you twist the tail of the dragon slowly. You want to get some energy out of them, but you don't want them to get angry. You don't want to let the reaction go too fast, too soon, beyond the point where it can be controlled. The nice thing about a fuel oil or a coal-fired power station is you bring in the fuel as you need it. Never more than a few minutes or a few hours worth in one spot at one time. Whereas in the case of nuclear power, you got to be a little bit more careful because you've got a couple of years' supply of fuel all in one spot, ready to go, and you want those megajoules and those gigajoules of energy to come out of there in a controlled manner, not too fast where you get a meltdown. So batteries have got this characteristic. So we're always going to have the trouble with the fact that we're all seeking batteries that have more energy in a smaller package. And as such, that concentration, if you don't have enough safety measures, can in theory give you trouble. You got it, Bill.
Yeah, Roger. I can say everything has got its pros and cons, and you got to be careful with whatever you work with. It could be dangerous, and I'm sure we've heard about all these exploding batteries in the laptops and whatever and all, but I think worst dangers to me are being outside. Don't go on a beach when there's lightning dancing around there. There's more people been killed down there than I'm sure have been ever hurt in any kind of exploding battery situation, wherever it is. We have every year there happens to be somebody getting hurt or killed here by the ocean. Last year we had two fatalities. One, a young boy on a bicycle riding along the edge of the water here, and he got killed by lightning. Got him right on top of the head. And another one, an older gentleman walking along, and they surmised he was on crutches, and he was using aluminum crutches. And I surmised that he picked the crutch up for 1 minute and raised it maybe above his head, and he was killed by the lightning instantly. So there is another sort, you know, of things that, you know, you got to be concerned of. But the battery situation, I think, Dick, may be blown a little bit out of, you know, proportion as to the safety of the batteries, because there's so many millions and millions of them out there, and you comparatively don't hear very much in the way of problems with them, Dick. Over.
Set time.
I'll accept that. Go ahead with lesson number three, Mel.
Okay, without any further ado, as they say, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I got some nice email about the Smith chart that we've been discussing for the last few weeks. And a number of people said they finally got to understand a little bit of it, because most of the time, whenever they see it mentioned in any of the articles in the magazines, they usually just skip over it because they never understand what the heck all those little lines do and why. I know there have been some articles were printed in some of the magazines on how to use the Smith chart, but for some reason they weren't clear enough on understanding how to use it, from what I gather from the emails. Oh, yes, before I go any further, Dick, there was a couple of emails that we discussed, you know, about the space shuttle and doing the service to the Hubble telescope, and they weren't very favorable about spending the money. One of the emails said, because if the whole world is going to use this type of technology to study the technology that the Hubble can produce, or the information the Hubble can produce, why don't they all chip in, instead of the American people going to have to pay billions of dollars to service this thing? These different countries that rely on the information coming from it should chip in some money, because they, for instance, they said, we don't get anything, they don't give us, the oil producing countries don't give us any oil for nothing. They want us to pay for their national treasure. And this is one of our treasures. This development is magnificent piece of equipment. So if they want to use it, they should have to pay something towards the servicing of it. Dick, I got a number of those emails, over.
I'm going to look into that a little bit further. As it is right now, you go to the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute, I think it's called, in Maryland, and you give them your proposal, and the number of scientists from your country that are allowed to have acceptable proposals and run projects on Hubble, I think, is somewhat proportional to the amount of financial contribution that that country has made to the project. It is a multinational project. To my knowledge, some of the very sensitive detectors and lens correctors and infrared and whatever detectors are on board, your wide-field planetary cameras and so on, some of those are built by European Space Agency, the Italian Space Agency, the Japan Space Agency, and so on. Already it is a multinational project, to my knowledge. I'm going to see if I can do a little bit more confirmation of that. And then after your lecture, we'll see if Paul of WS2N happens to have any words on that. So already, it is not a purely United States contribution. I think, just like the International Space Station, is definitely multinational. I mean, you and I may complain about the fact that the Soviet Union didn't come through with quite as number of the exact number of dollars they originally promised, because they went through a bankruptcy situation. But still, just like the International Space Station is truly international, I think to some degree so is Hubble. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
This case, Roger, according to this gentleman, we're going to pay 87%. He says there are a number of other countries that do contribute either scientifically or monetarily, but we'll wind up at 87% cost to West government. All right, anyhow, let's let that go for the time being. One of the questions that I got on the email, something I didn't, I guess, cover, really, what is the scale underneath the Smith chart, that scale that looks like a part of, they said part of a slide rule. That was funny, part of a slide rule. What is it used for, really? How do you use it? And that's very simple. In fact, I'll tell you what, let's give it an example, a quick example. Let's plot a point, let's take a measurement, similar to what we did last week, of 32 ohms resistive plus J, 20 ohms. In other words, an inductive resistance of plus J, 20. And like we always did in the past, now we normalize it by dividing it by 50, and we get a 0.64 plus J, 0.4. So we locate this point. Now we're going to go on the resistance axis, and we're going to find 0.64, approximately. You don't have to be that precise. And then you'll look down on the reactants and on the 0.4 of the reactant curve, and you'll see that where they two meet, we'll call that 0.0. Put a pencil mark there. And now take your compass and put the pin on the compass on 1.0 like we've done in the past, and swing a circle, put the point on the pencil point on that point we just made, and we're going to swing a circle all around. And once we do that, now we're going to take our straight edge, and we're going to go perpendicular line where you see the circle crosses the axis of reals. That's that center axis. We're going to drop a perpendicular straight down from those two points on either side of the circle where it crosses there, right through the scale on the bottom. Anybody have any questions? Okay, once we do that, now if you'll notice on the scale on the bottom, if you look on the edge, it says SWR. If you move along there where this line now crosses there, you'll be able to reach your SWR, which should be exactly what you're reading on your handheld antenna analyzer, or however you're measuring it. That will give you SWR. If you look on the next line right below there, you'll see your return loss in dBs. You can read that, and so on and so forth. You can see your reflection coefficient. If you look on the other side, where the line came down on the other side, you can see all the attenuation law and dB loss and et cetera. All the different factors, in other words, about what you just plotted. It just gives you, this is a simple graph of what you just plotted to simply read off the information, which is handy at times to use this bottom, what they actually, a nomograph, Dick, over.
WB2HWW with a question, please.
Okay, we'll get to your question in a minute. Yes, I would call it a linear scale, an interpretation scale, a nomograph. It's got a lot of different names. And by the way, I've been getting a couple of communications during the week by people who've said, I've been hearing about the Smith chart for years. I've been working in the wireless world for years. I've been afraid of the darn thing. And all of a sudden, you guys are starting to explain it, and it's starting to make sense. I'm hearing those words. Howie, go ahead.
If you want to normalize the impedance, don't you have to turn the R plus J into a polar coordinates to do it, Dick? Or am I all wrong? If you want to divide by something, if you want to normalize it, wouldn't you have to turn it into polar coordinates first to do the math and then go back to rectangular?
Yes and no. I've got a set of formulas that I use all the time. For instance, Mel just gave us an example of resistive component, 32 ohms, reactive component, plus J, 20. So in my case of my handheld 28S, I simply put in open parentheses, 32, comma, 20, close parentheses. That's the format that Hewlett-Packard 28S handheld scientific calculator will accept it in. That already is in rectangular form. And if I go to, I'm going to do it right now. Let's see, I want to 3 roll, okay. Good. I brought it down to the operating portion of the screen. I now take 320, which is in rectangular form, and I press the key that goes from rectangular to polar, and it tells me it equals in polar form 37.7 ohms of total impedance at an angle of plus 32 degrees. So you could take it in rectangular form and immediately convert it to polar. You can do something else to really answer your more direct question, Howie, and that is, without converting it to rectangular, without converting it to polar form, leaving it in rectangular form, the form that Mel just gave it to us in, we can immediately find out what is the reflection coefficient. In other words, how many volts comes reflecting back to you if that was your antenna and you got a 50-ohm transmission line going there. So you take that impedance in complex rectangular form, 32, J plus 20, and then you, let me call that Z. Let's call it ZL, Z of the load. If you then take Z of the load and subtract Z0, divide that by Z of the load plus Z0. So in other words, I take the 32 plus J20, put that on top of a fraction, subtract 50 real from it. Put the exact same Z load, 32 plus J20, on the bottom of the fraction, add 50 to that, then perform that division in rectangular. It turns out that many of the equations are difficult, are more easy to use in rectangular form. Some of them, depending on your favorite kind of mathematics with complex, are easier to use in polar form. But when it comes to calculating reflection coefficient, I just gave you the exact equation, ZL minus Z0 divided by ZL plus Z0. That resultant fraction, when you perform the indicated division, divide the number below the line into the number above the line, you get an answer in rectangular form as to the exact impedance, in rectangular form. You then take the absolute value of that, you know the absolute value of the reflection coefficient. Convert that before taking the absolute value into polar form, and you now know the angle. And there is other ways of getting the angle without converting to polar. So the full information as to reflected power, we usually care about the magnitude. We then use that, whatever that magnitude is, we usually call it the Greek letter rho. 1 plus rho divided by 1 minus rho equals standing wave ratio. And the numbers that that he just gave us happen to give us a standing wave ratio of 1.936, or 1.94. So should it be polar, should it be rectangular? I say the answer is yes, depending on which form of the mathematics you use. I guarantee there's ways of doing everything in pure polar. There's probably ways of doing things in pure rectangular. There are ways of combining the two to make it simpler, depending on how you learned it. Complex is complicated. There's a pun there somewhere. There's more than one way to skin this particular cat. Maybe that made some sense, Howie. Back to you, Howie. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay. You add in rectangular and you divide in polar. Now, he told everybody, take 32 and divide it by 50. And then take 20 and divide that by 50. I don't think that's correct. I might be wrong, Dick. He basically divided the 32 plus 20J by 50. Now, he didn't normalize, he didn't take the top thing and turn it into a polar coordinate and divide it by 50 at an angle of zero.
Don't agree. Well, what Mel didn't give you all the words, but he took 32 and divided by 50. That allows him to normalize the resistive component. That's the 0.64. He took the 20 and divided it by 50. That normalizes the reactive component. That gave him the 0.4. That is perfectly legal normalization operation of a Smith chart. I'll admit that your and my professors, maybe it was Dr. Boyette at Pratt Institute, his favorite way of doing it may have been to convert to polar and then divide. You don't have to. You can normalize by taking the resistive component divided by 50. That gives you the normalized resistive component. Take the reactive component, divide by 50. That gives you the normalized reactive component. Then you can go straight to the Smith chart with that by looking at the normalized R and the normalized X. What Boyette taught you and I to do is to convert it to polar, and then you take the polar form, which is the radius of the compass circle you're going to swing, and the polar angle, which you now use as the perimeter of the chart in order to make a dot on that circle, which is your particular impedance. Both systems work. I think Mel has chosen the easier one, because some of the guys listening to this are going to have a little trouble converting from rectangular to polar. You've been through that with Boyette. You know how to do it. Many of us don't remember it that way. Wonder if that makes some sense, Howie. Go ahead.
It's actually easier to do it his way. All right, because you have to go through a couple of steps. That's the way I was taught. I was taught to do transmissions, you know, to go back and forth, whatever was easy. All right, just wanted to make that comment, Dick. Sorry for busting in. WD2HW.
No, I'm glad you did, because a certain fraction of the world out there was taught the Boyette way, convert to polar before doing the operation. Well, that forces you to use the perimeter of the chart and drawing circles, drawing with a straight edge from the center out to the perimeter, choosing the right number of degrees of phase angle before you intercept your circle of absolute magnitude of the polar form in order to find out where you are. The technique that Mel has got you doing allows you to go straight to the dot on the chart. I think he's got a slightly simpler process. I'm going to back him on this one. You got it, Mel.
Roger, that's why I picked it. I know exactly what Howie is coming and going from, because I've dealt with that before in school. And I think that I'm going to try to keep it more or less on a simpler basis, Dick, because what we just brought up now, I'm going to hit upon that gradually. I'm going to hit upon it a little bit tonight, but I don't want to get too deep in because we will lose most everybody, Dick. So let's leave it basically like this. As I said, we normalized it by dividing 50, 32 by 50, and 20 by 50, and we got the 0.64 plus J0.4. We drew a circle. We used that point. Put our pin on 1.0 in the center of the chalk. Put the pencil on that point. We call that O. Make a little O next to it, and I'll tell you why it's few minutes, maybe a little easy to remember that way. And we swing the circle, and then we brought down the perpendiculars, and we looked at the nomograph on the bottom, the radically scaled chart on the bottom. All right, now let's take a bit of a hypothetical case. Well, last week I mentioned a simple matching system that if you wanted to have, as I wanted to, or that one frequency on 75 meters from my mobile, a little bit better matching system. And I showed you how simply we could find out what was necessary by using a capacitance and an inductance in series, similar simple L network like you would have in a tuna, except not to have to carry a whole tuna with you in a mobile if you just want for that specific area of frequency, and put together a very simple tuning device that helped give the transmitter a little bit better matching situation. Now, let's take another hypothetical case. Let's say you're at field day. We'll talk about another matching method. You're at field day, and you put up an antenna, and you're operating your phone band, works pretty good, and you decide, let's go down to the CW portion of the band. And it's not such a good match there when you move to the CW portion of the band. You take some measurements and you see that's where your problem is. But you don't have a tuner with you, and there is no spare tuners available. What can you do? Well, there's another way of doing it. There are plenty of coax around and connectors. We can use what we call a stub matching situation. And do I have to explain a stub? Is everybody out there familiar with a stub? It's basically a length of coax with a short on one end. Any other questions about a stub before I go any further?
Comments from the net in 2EO.
Yeah, I'm going to say a couple of words on a stub. The exotic way, the classy way of putting a stub somewhere on a transmission line is to open up the transmission line in that area, put a connector on each end, put a T connector at that location, and then on the third port of the T connector, you hang this piece of coax cable that you've carefully chosen to be the right length, and either a short or an open, depending on whether it's a shorted stub or an open stub. So a T connector is the exotic way of putting a coaxial stub impedance matching device somewhere in the length of your transmission line. If you're real, real lucky, it may turn out that the right location for the stub is right at the antenna, and you don't have to install more connectors and a T connector. But the right way to do it in shunt is a T connector. There are ways of putting a stub in series with the transmission line, but for physical reasons and weatherproofing reasons, it's a lot more difficult. Most of us will choose, if at all possible, a shunting type stub, because putting one in series tends to be a lot more difficult. Let's see what Rich has got to say. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Net time.
Okay, Dick, I have something from the net, unrelated to what you're saying, if you have time at the end of the net. But first of all, I was testing on 1200 megahertz, and I do believe I may have been interfering with Howard in the net, so I just realized that I want to apologize to Howard, and I want to apologize to you and the people on the net. Back to you, Dick.
Not to worry, Rich. We were hearing a very weak carrier in the background. We were all overriding it with no SWIFT, so we didn't even know it was interference. We thought it was a repeater from far away coming through with a band opening, and it was weak, so not to worry. So, that's a stub, usually in shunt. But if your back's against the wall, and if you try hard enough, there are ways of putting a stub in series with a transmission line. Easier to do with twin leads than with coax. Kind of difficult to put a series stub. But what happens, and the reason why you put a stub there, is that when you're transmitting at 100 watts or 1,000 watts, and you want to hang a capacitor or an inductor across the center conductor to shield on your transmission line, you're putting in a shunt capacitor, center conductor to shield, and you want that transmitting, you want that capacitor to be rated for full transmitter power, 1,500 watts. Go into your junk box and you try to find a capacitor that can do that and do it well and be weatherproofed and somehow put it inside the coax cable at just the right number of feet back from the antenna and have it not blow up. That's a difficult requirement. The magic of transmission lines is that you choose the right length of transmission line, another piece of transmission line, you choose the right length and short circuit the far end and the input end, center conductor to shield, you connect it with a T connector at your chosen location, that thing is called a stub, choose the right length of the right Z0 transmission line, and it makes for you a real high power equivalent capacitor. That's hard to believe, but it's true. If the stub is shorted at the far end and less than a quarter wavelength long, it is a inductor. If it's beyond a quarter wavelength long, it is a capacitor. Depending on how much shorter or longer than quarter wave determines exactly how many picofarad or how many microhenry, how many nanohenry, how many microhenry, or how many picofarad or how many microfarads. Just by choosing the length at that frequency. That's the magic of this jazz. Correspondingly, you can make the stub open circuited. A stub less than quarter wavelength long that's an open circuit is a capacitor. The capacitor becomes real big as your length of line open circuited approaches quarter wave from the short side. Make it only 1 inch long and you're making a picofarad. Make it exactly a quarter wavelength long and you can simulate microfarads. And it's a transmitting rated capacitor. Just a simple piece of coax cable. You know, 10 cents worth of hardware is equivalent to a $200 capacitor. Transmitting rated, weatherproof, the works. So transmission line acting as a capacitor or acting as an inductor, if you're smart enough with a Smith chart, man, can that do magic. That can take your 10 to 1 standing wave ratio antenna at your favorite frequency and make it 1 to 1. Standing wave ratio, once you know how to use a Smith chart. That's where Mel's going. When he gets there, when he brings all of us there, there's going to be a little bit of a cheer. You've got it, Mel. K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY, isn't it right? I thank Dick for clarifying it a little bit. All right, now we have the stub, and let's say now we're going to use, in this particular case, we're going to use this piece of cable with a short on one end. Now, as Dick said with the stub, we got to know two things. We got to know the distance the stub is going to be placed from our transmitter, and we got to know the length of the cable that we need to make the stub. So if you want to do this by hitting this, I think field day would be over before you get finished making up this piece of cable, which can easily be done with the Smith chart. This will be a good example of making up a simple matching system. If you take the Smith chart now, and if you see where we drew that circle, use what we did already, so use that as an example. You see that point O that I told you to mark originally where we swung the circle initially. Now, if you take your straight edge, you're going to draw a line from point O right straight through to 1.0 point on the Smith chart, right out to the outer edge of the Smith chart, right straight through the outer edge. Now, where it crosses this line that we just drew, where it crosses our circle, I'm going to mark that capital B, and I'll tell you what that is for. And at the end of the line where it crosses over out of the outside of this circle, Smith chart, make another B there, extend it. In other words, extending the line B straight through. Now, as you can see, with adding a piece of cable like this, it's going to present somewhat of a complex impedance. It's not a simple match like we talked about last week. And a little bit about this is we're going to get into a thing called what we basically call admittance data. Admittance, let me put it to you simply, let me see if I can explain it simply. Admittance requires that we have the reciprocal of, for instance, of resistance. We were dealing with resistance, and the reciprocal of resistance is actually conductance, and it's usually represented by a capital G. So, simply put, if we have 1 over R, if we have reciprocal of 1 over R, and if you see that if we have a low resistance, we're going to have a high conductance. I hope I explained that correctly. And also, there's another terminology that we use in reactants. The reciprocal reactance is subceptance is the reciprocal of reactance, and it's represented by capital letter B or beta. And by the way, conductance is usually measured in what we call Siemens. Now, so again, just remember that conductance being the reciprocal, of resistance, 1 over R. So the lower the resistance, the higher the conductance. The higher the resistance, the lower the conductance. Any questions on that? I hope I didn't lose anybody.
Yeah, I'm going to put in a couple of words on that one, Mel. And this reciprocal jazz, at first, is a little bit mysterious. And to bring it down to something that some people will understand a little better, not everybody, you may have heard of something called Thevenin impedance. Somebody gave you a black box, and he told you there's a signal generator in there, and that signal generator has some impedance. If it's my favorite transmitter, I'd like the answer to be it's a 100-watt transmitter, and it's got a 50-ohm impedance. Well, those are the words of a Thevenin equivalent circuit. 100-watt signal generator, which is some number of volts, and going through a series resistor of exactly 50 ohms, and then it comes out to the output terminals of the black box. That's my 50-watt transmitter equivalent circuit. That's a Thevenin equivalent. Some ideal signal generator in there as a voltage generator in series with some resistor, which you and I call the impedance, and that's my 50-ohm signal generator, my 50-ohm source. Somebody else could give me another box, a second black box, and he's got the word Norton written across it. And I make a measurement on the Norton box, and then I make a measurement on the Thevenin box. From the outside of the box, I cannot tell the difference. They act the same exactly in each case. Each one is a 100-watt transmitter. Each one looks like a 50-ohm impedance. However, if I look inside the Norton box, it isn't an ideal voltage generator. It's an ideal current generator. And the 50-ohm resistor is not in series with the signal generator. It's in parallel. It's across it. Because a ideal current generator is theoretically an open circuit, when I put my 50-ohm resistor across it, it acts like a 50-ohm signal generator. Before that, it was an infinite. So from the outside of the box, I can't tell the difference, whether it's a current generator with a 50-ohm resistor across it, or in the case of the Thevenin, it's a voltage generator with a 50-ohm resistor in series with it. From the outside world, they look the same. But in order to handle the mathematics of this, if I had the idea